This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, everybody. Mike Snyder with you again for another edition of Travel Talk, where we explore the world through the pages of Condé Nast Traveler magazine. And we'll be continuing our travels through the April 2024 edition, plus online articles. And let's start with this. Paradise Found, once a haven for backpackers and divers, the Pacific archipelago of Palau is reinventing itself as the next great luxury getaway. And there are a couple of great photographs. Here's one of a swimmer who's up to her waist, and in the background is a huge rock formations. And another picture from above shows a snorkeler surrounded by jellyfish as he's snorkeling through the water. And here is the story. After snorkeling with the dazzling fish of Palau's crystalline waters, I returned to my hotel and gratefully accepted a hibiscus lemonade and a cold lemongrass towel, a needed balm after baking in the equatorial sun. At the spa, the therapist treated my burns with a bespoke massage fusing Palauan remedies with common sense aloe. I woke to a vermilion sunset after being lulled to sleep by the gentle rocking of the waves. This is not the typical guest experience in Palau, a pristine and far-flung tropical archipelago east of the Philippines. The island's vibrant coral reefs have long attracted the world's most avid divers, but the country's lack of luxury infrastructure has excluded it from the five-star travel circuit. That's about to change, however. I stayed aboard the Four Seasons Explorer, a posh 11-cabin yacht that arrived in Palau last October as a sort of advance guard for the hotel brand, which plans to build an onshore resort in the future. The country hopes that this will be the first of many high-profile arrivals as it seeks to recalibrate its image. In the past, our visitors only knew diving and the ocean, said Surungel Whips Jr., Palau's president. Then we had a big wave of tourists from mainland China in 2015, and that damaged the environment. He wore a sea blue shirt as he sat in his office in Koror, Palau's biggest city, population 11,000, discussing the need to create jobs for local Palauans who are increasingly going off-island in search of work and to prevent Palau from being overrun with visitors. We don't need to be the next Phuket, he told me. To protect the ecosystem and mitigate the impact of mass tourism, Palau is building a luxury tourism model. Read High Spend, Low Volume, by courting some of the ritziest names in hospitality. While the country knows that nature is its top draw, it is also leaning on another rich resource, its culture. The Ali'i Pass program, launched by the Palau Visitors Authority in 2018 and revived in 2022 after the pandemic, offers community-led tours with Palauan experts all over the country. These include long-time must-dos like snorkeling in Jellyfish Lake, as well as surprises like an historic World War II tour on Palilau Island and a visit to the ancient stone monoliths of Engarchelong. One trip took me to the mangrove-fringed state of Airai, where locals welcomed me and the explorer crew with Palauan songs and insight into indigenous customs. We don't let just anyone explain our histories or sites, said Velma Obak, our guide in Airai. We stood before the majestic Airai Bai, a centuries-old meeting house, as she narrated the legends depicted on the building's facade. As a historian, she's working with Palau's education ministry to ensure that the cultural knowledge she's researched is shared with fellow Palauans, not just with visitors. This goal of preservation of both nature and heritage is the mantra of Heather Kettenbang of the Palau Conservation Society, who took me birdwatching through the Rock Islands, a necklace of forested limestone columns resembling giant emeralds in a turquoise sea, where white terns and kingfishers sped past. Back on the Explorer, I asked her if she believed tourism could coexist with conservation. Yes, she said, but it must be a form of tourism that supports conservation, giving back to nature while hosting its stewards and thoughtful visitors who want to see Palau both above and below the waves. I want everyone, including my children and grandchildren, to see Palau the way I see it today. And here's a little sidebar of information about Palau. They call it the dossier. Palau, population 18,000 in 2021. Languages spoken, English and Palauan. World first, Palau banned shark fishing in 2009. Keep an eye out for the rainbow-plumed Palauan fruit dove. And that story by Matt Ortile. And now a look at several deluxe locations around the world. And here's the title of the article, Privacy Please. And there's a great photograph showing a young woman in long pants and a loose shirt walking through some dunes. And at the top of the dunes, they're capped by some foliage. And it's really a striking photograph. You have just have that light brown sand topped by arches of dark green foliage. So again, privacy, please. All over the world, the demand for exclusive travel experiences is booming, from yacht charters and full-service villas to off-the-book itineraries. Travelers are avoiding the crowds while seeking out bespoke cultural immersions curated by well-connected local experts who can promise access, intimacy, and free reign. And here's the article. And of course, there are several photographs of the properties that we're going to be describing here. But let's start with this. There's a scene in Succession, that near Shakespearean takedown of the super rich, where eldest son Connor complains that he had to fly back scheduled, quote unquote. Family patriarch Logan Roy oozes sarcasm. Oh, I'm sorry, son, that's really tough. In fairness to misquote Kate Moss, nothing tastes as good as private feels right now, especially when you're at 41,000 feet being served a menu concocted by Jean-Georges Van Richten. The private airplane has been the poster child of elite travel ever since the original jet setters started flying down to Acapulco with Sinatra on the airwaves or on board in the 1950s. There is an eternal allure to taking off at a whim, unscheduled. Put simply, to freedom. But recently, our idea of exclusive travel has broadened. There is an inclination to go further and deeper, to be more spontaneous and creative, with bucket lists overflowing. Since the era of social distancing, a desire to reconnect with friends and family has led to more ambitious group trips. The rise of hyper-personalization is trouncing the one-size-fits-all holiday thanks to canny travel fixers and tour operators that are threading the desire for far-off menu, bespoke experiences into travelers' ever-evolving DNA. That could look like a marine safari around Lamu on a chartered private dhow with Journeys by Design, or a buyout of Venice's Palazzo Garzoni, take all four residences, or Thuwal private retreat in the Red Sea, take the whole island. Hotels are getting wise, adding private residences, like Rosewood London's Lincoln House and the aptly named Via Incognito, pictured, and that's one of the photographs, at Oslo's Somero, while the Reserve at Savoy Palace in Madeira has just unveiled a hotel within a hotel, complete with a personal assistant, just a WhatsApp message away. And if what you crave is total solitude, save for perhaps the primates in the wilds of Gabon, experts like Pelarus can curate a bespoke expedition just for you without ever skimping on all the luxe comforts. Now that is a new style of luxury, and that description by Rick Jordan. And now we'll go through a description of some specific properties associated with that article. Hotels heightened. It's no surprise that hotels are riding the private travel wave, granting guests exclusive access, bespoke experiences, and even greater privacy concierges are acting more like personal fixers at J.K. Place Roma in the 17th century Palazzo Borghese. Giulia De Sanctis uses her connections to take visitors behind the curtain of the Italian fashion scene, from exclusive events for new collections to coveted invitations like Vogue's Valentino Shindig. Tours are getting more elaborate, too. The Four Seasons Hotel Sydney can organize a private jet to the Lightning Ridge Opal Mines. The creative director of the jeweler Julian's, Gary Coffey, tags along and helps attendees craft their own one-of-a-kind piece. And beyond the presidential suite, some hotels offer secluded villas on their grounds, from the pool cottage house at Mallorca's Grand Hotel Son Net, complete with their own pool and garden, to the five-bedroom Villa de France, with dedicated butler service at the Cheval Blanc St. Bart, and price upon request, darling. And that property is pictured here. And on to another, La Dolce Villa. Of course, instead of a top hotel, you could just book your own estate, which offers the same level of service, but allows you to go anywhere you like in your pajamas. And when it comes to these rentals, bigger is indeed better. We've seen increased demand for our largest villas as more people bring the whole family or big groups of friends, said Rossella Bogier, co-founder of luxury villa specialist The Thinking Traveler. And below are some options for a grand getaway with or without your entourage. The Casa Alma Phuket, Thailand. Escape the island's crowds and abscond into one of two or both residences at this sleek, jungle-fringed hideaway owned by Thai-Belgian hotelier Jonathan Schmidt. Another property, Via Zaina, Luxor, Egypt. Photographer and designer Zaina Aboukir rents out her five-suite residence, which is overflowing with art from her travels. Don't forget the private butler and chef service. Then the Casino Doxy Sraca in Puglia, Italy, which is pictured here also. Drive through the estate's 5 acres of vineyards to this 18th century marvel, filled with amenities like multiple pools, a wine cellar, and, blessedly, air conditioning. Casa Manantial, Cartagena, Colombia. This 17th century mansion, hidden behind an unmarked door off Plaza de Bolivar, makes for an artful city escape, complete with a pool and room for up to 10. And here's an article that showcases four specific properties in Africa. Solo sightings. For so long, safaris were a communal affair, but in recent years, game-ready private houses have come into their own. And here are the movement's pioneers and their photographs of each of these properties. House in the Wild, Kenya. This 7-lodge compound, tucked into a lush bend of the Mara River, is owned by Tarkeen and Lipa Woods, founders of the surrounding Enokishu Conservancy. After lunch, grab a swinging bed on the riverbank and watch the hippos wallowing nearby. Now, Anduli Enclave in Namibia. Atop a granite outcropping that overlooks the ochre terrain of Damaraland, this villa, addition to the Anduli Ridge, is composed of three exclusive use stilted suites that come with their own guide, butler, and chef, and even an airstrip for aerial transfers. The next, Melot House in South Africa. Dug directly into the landscape like an eco-bond lair, this high-design lodge sits in South Africa's rhino-friendly Lapalola Wilderness Reserve, fully staffed for game drives, boat cruises, and spa treatments. And finally, Singita Milili in Tanzania. These 5 suites sit on a prime wildebeest migration outlook in Tanzania's iconic Grumeti Reserve. For winding down after daily drives, this villa has a movie room, a stocked wine cellar, and an infinity pool. So let's get away from that hot equatorial weather and go to Mongolia, with a lot of snow in this article, A Place in Time. Stanley Stewart revisits the Mongolian steppes of his past and loses himself again in a world of wild horses, chain-smoking shamans, and the haunting songs of nomads. When people ask me what is my favorite place in the whole wide world of places to which I have traveled, there is never any hesitation. I love Mongolia so much that I once spent 5 months crossing 1,000 miles of it on horseback. The baggage horse loaded with a rattling collection of gear, from a temperamental stove to a rapidly disappearing bottle of whiskey. I wrote a book about the journey that was translated into 12 languages. I fell in love with a Mongolian, an intense affair that unwound over years. It ended 2 decades ago. She has moved on wisely, but Mongolia is still there, and it was time to go back. From the air, the emptiness is always startling. Flying over Mongolia before dawn, I saw no lights below, just unfolding landscapes. A spooling river, a range of mountains surging across steppelands, an empire of grass tipping to undisturbed horizons. Only Greenland and the Falkland Islands have a lower population density. The one sign of habitation were the occasional encampments of round white yurts, known here as gers, and G-E-R-S, which appear suddenly and mysteriously in the grasslands like overnight mushrooms. In a few weeks, they will vanish and spring up elsewhere, leaving no trace other than the pale circles on the grass as the nomads move to winter pastures. Mongolia is the world's last truly nomadic realm. I landed in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia's capital and its only real city, with traffic that would shame Manhattan, and one of the highest pollution levels in the world. It seemed the antithesis of the country over which it presides. I got out of town as quickly as I could and entered into a landscape that might have been carved by the wind. I didn't have 5 months this time. The plan was to spend 10 days in the country, visiting a couple of regions with a driver, a guide, and my photographer friend, Alistair Taylor Young, to whom I had been enthusing about Mongolia for years. My Mongolian calendar for the trip was surprisingly full. I had an appointment with a shaman. I planned to search for wild horses and visit eagle hunters. In between, I would look for myself, for my connection to this place, for what drew me here, for who I had been all those years ago. We began at the beginning, among the wild horses and standing stones of Kustane Nuru National Park. Mongolia was home to the Przewalski's horse, known in Mongolia as the Taki, the only authentically wild horses left on earth. But by the 1960s, these short and thick-chested creatures had become extinct in the wild. Then, in 1992, using stock from zoos, breeders successfully reintroduced them to their homeland in this park. And Kustane's high valleys, deer stones, so named for the carvings they bear of prehistoric hoofed animals, stand knee-deep in thickets of grass, roughly the height of a man. The stones are the only visible remnants of a little-known culture that inhabited this landscape up to 4,000 years ago. I scanned the hills with binoculars. High on the slopes, I could see a herd of red deer moving toward the ridgeline. With the protection of rangers, Kustane has become a sanctuary for them. They are vulnerable to poaching. Deer penis is sought after in traditional Chinese medicine. Then I spotted the horses, a tawny-colored group, females and foals, under the command of a single stallion. I suddenly felt I was peering into the Bronze Age. Horses are the central fact of Mongolian history. Their domestication on these steppes created powerful nomadic empires, prompted the building of the Great Wall by the Chinese, who were anxious about invasion, and carried the armies of Genghis Khan to the walls of Vienna in the 13th century. Later, on the banks of the Tuul River, where a pair of whooper swans glided beneath willows, we stopped at a ger, where a bow-legged woman was milking a restive mob of Mongolian horses. The milking of both yaks and horses is a tricky business, requiring a firm hand and cool nerves, the consensus in Mongolia is that women do a better job at it. Inside the ger, a young woman served us bowls of fermented mare's milk, known as erag, a kind of sour milky beer that is Mongolia's chief tipple. Our host, warming his toes by the stove, was 90 years old. His face was a map. I asked him to tell me what he thought were Mongolia's best years. I was hoping he would reflect on the country's history. Mongolia was the second communist nation. It had spent 70 years as a satellite of the Soviet Union. Capitalism had arrived with a thud in 1990. The 1930s, he said, looking at me with rheumy eyes. I asked why. Because I was boy in those years. We traveled westward, crossing a low pass to a wide plain where sunlight and cloud chased each other across the dun-colored grasses. On a ridge above a silver stream, we found the shaman's camp. Crows swirled upward above a ger. Inside was the shaman, Amar Jargal, a woman in her 50s. Shamanism has a tenacious hold on the Mongolian imagination. Even as the country became Buddhist in the 16th century, the herdsmen found solace in its reassuring rituals and its promise of contact with the spirit world. In the 21st century, the dramatic changes of the modern world in such a traditional society have inspired a revival of shamanism. Amar Jargal's day was packed, but she agreed to make time to perform a quote-unquote beckoning, a calling upon the spirits for me. While her husband lit cones of incense, Amar Jargal donned the shaman's headdress, known as umskull. It had a screen of hair that concealed her eyes and much of her face, and was adorned with eagle feathers. Seated in front of her husband, who seemed to act as both manager and roadie, she began to strum a mouth harp. The single repetitive note slowly built to a frantic pace, then suddenly subsided as a spirit entered her, taking over her body. Head bowed, she growled. A low animal sound filled the ger. Her husband lit a cigarette and handed it to her. After a couple of moments, he lit another. The spirit turned out to be a chain smoker. After three more Marlboros, Amar Jargal's husband turned to ask me what I wished to know. I wasn't sure what to say. I had no idea there was going to be a question and answer session. I hemmed, I hawed. The spirit world was waiting. Amar Jargal's spirit was growling again. Finally, I blurted out, "Will I have a successful journey? What should I expect?" Amar Jargal tensed like an animal, crouched on the mat, with puffs of cigarette smoke coming out from beneath the headdress. Then the spirit spoke, sounding eerily like Marlon Brando. "You will find nothing on this journey. What you need is to be found at home." After a couple more butts and some additional frenzied mouth harp action, the spirit departed whence it came. Suddenly I did have questions, lots of them. Why hadn't I asked about life after death, sent greetings to a deceased relative, or at the very least gotten a hot tip for Mongolian's Nadam horse races? Slumped now at the head of the ger, Amar Jargal looked depleted. She had removed the headdress. The spirit was gone, and after a few pleasantries, so were we. 2 days later, I flew west to Bayan Olgi in a propeller plane full of passengers carrying saddles and blankets. From the airfield, we set off in 4x4, passing a herd of shaggy yaks looking mournful on the edge of a lake. Camels appeared, strolling elegantly in loping slow motion, like elderly promenaders. For several miles, we followed a river winding through a gravel floodplain, then ascended over low hills and looked down on a wide valley carpeted with yellow grass. Stopping the car, we climbed out. In the middle of the valley was a single ger with a smoking chimney. At the far end, their backs to sculptural outcrops of black rock, were five more. This was Mandala Altai, our home for the next 4 days. It felt splendidly remote, a place removed from the world's complexities and our own petty struggles. On a far hillside, I could see a miniature figure of a horseman. Even at this great distance, I could hear the soft murmur of the hooves. With their womb-like embrace, gers are the accommodation of choice in Mongolia. While maintaining the atmosphere of the nomads' tents, the visitors' versions across the country have reached a level of glamping luxury that is surprising in such remote regions. Furnished with patterned Mongolian chests and tables, Mandala Altai had beds piled with the luxury linens. Each gur is centered around a wood-burning stove. In the early mornings, an attendant would creep in to light it so the tent was cozy when we awoke. An adjoining gur acted as a spacious bathroom with hot water, an elegant open shower, and a compost loo. A central dining gur was the setting for evening aperitifs and lavish meals. In the morning, we went to visit our neighbors, the area's only other inhabitants, who lived in a single gur in the middle of the valley, a quarter of a mile off. A couple of horses were tethered outside. Sitting on perches close to the gur were two magnificent golden eagles. Western Mongolia is home to the Kazakhs, a Muslim minority who have long tradition of hunting with eagles. Inside the gur, we met the eagle hunter Tastulek. When I asked how he acquired his eagles, he described climbing the face of a cliff to an eagle nest and choosing a female chick from the brood, all the while fending off the mother, a creature with a wingspan of almost 7 feet and a curved, flesh-ripping bill, as if talking about a visit to Walmart. But he was not unsentimental. The Kazakhs say an eagle is a member of the family. When the birds reach about 6 or 7 years of age, their keepers release them into the wild again. Tastulek was in mourning. One of the birds outside, whom he had raised from a chick, was due to be released soon. In this landscape, the weather is unpredictable. One night, winter came. I woke to hear winds singing in the ropes of the gear and wolves howling from the ridge behind us. In the morning, snowdrifts were banked around the tents beneath a slate-colored sky. We had a breakfast of warm, sweet porridge and mugs of coffee, and then set off on horses, riding south into a newly white world. On horseback again, I remember the delight of my previous journey and the way it had stripped away all the measures of self, aspirations, fears, desires, all the nagging preoccupations. In the immense solitude of Mongolia, I had felt liberated. I had been content with the physical sensation of the present, the contours of a sloping valley, the way the light fell on a distant lake, the sense of movement, the horses jerking their heads. Now, once again, life was reduced to these delightful simplicities and to that rare feeling that this was enough and that I didn't need anything else. And on that note brings us to the end of another edition of Travel Talk. Mike Snyder, good being with you this time. Look forward to being with you next time. Until then, bon voyage for now.